Appendix 2, Thinking and Meditation. As in the case of many other words used in psychology, for example, mind, personality, soul, different meanings are ascribed to the word meditation. In its more restricted sense, it can be regarded as synonymous with disciplined thought or reflection on an idea. More broadly, it embraces other kinds of inner action, for which disciplined thought is a prerequisite. In psychosynthesis, meditation is considered and practiced in this wider connotation. We shall thus indicate, with appropriate terminology as the need arises, the types of meditation we wish to discuss. The three principal types are reflective meditation, receptive meditation, creative meditation. Meditation, to be effective, needs adequate preparation. It is a matter of passing from normal life with its outward orientation, in which interest and attention are monopolized by our concerns, plans, and activities, to the inner action of meditation. This preparation is triple: physical, emotional, and mental. 1. Physical relaxation. The most thorough elimination possible of all muscular and nervous tension. 2. Emotional composure. The endeavour to assume a state of tranquility. 3. Mental recollection. The direction of the mind's interest and attention inward. 1. Reflective meditation. In the simplest definition, its simplest definition is to think. An accurate but limited definition, since clear ideas on the functions of thinking are not common property. It has been stated that the mind thinks in us, rather than it being we who formulate thoughts. Indeed, the working of our minds normally proceeds spontaneously under the action of stimuli and interests of various kinds, and in a disorganized way. The mind operates independently of the will, and often in opposition to it. This lack of mastery over the mind has well been described by Swami Vivekananda. How hard it is to control the mind! Well has it been compared to the maddened monkey. There was a monkey, restless by his own nature, as all monkeys are. As if that were not enough, someone made him drink freely of wine, so that he became still more restless. Then a scorpion stung him. When a man is stung by a scorpion, he jumps about for the whole day, so the poor monkey found his condition worse than ever. To complete his misery, a demon entered into him. What language can describe the uncontrollable restlessness of that monkey? The human mind is like that monkey, incessantly active by its own nature. Then it becomes drunk with the wine of desire, thus increasing its turbulence. After the desire takes possession, comes the sting of the scorpion of jealousy, of the success of others, and last of all the demon of pride enters the mind, making it think itself of all importance. How hard to control such a mind! The first lesson, then, is to sit for some time and let the mind run on. The mind is bubbling up all the time. It is like that monkey jumping about. Let the monkey jump as much as he can. You simply wait and watch. Knowledge is power, says the proverb, and that is true. Until you know what the mind is doing, you cannot control it. Give it rein. Many hideous thoughts may come into it. You may be astonished that it was possible for you to think such thoughts. But you will find that each day the mind's vagaries are becoming less and less violent, that each day it is becoming calmer. In the first few months you will find that the mind will have a great many thoughts. Later you will find that they have somewhat decreased, and in a few more months they will be fewer and fewer, until at last mind will be under perfect control. But we must patiently practice every day. Much of our ordinary mental activity, then, does not merit the term thought. It is only when a dominating interest, backed by a firm and decided will, is able to hold the mind concentrated on an idea or task, that it really thinks, and we can say that it reflects. it meditates. Thus there are those who meditate without calling their mental activity that. For example, the scientist seeking the solution to a problem, the businessman working out a program for the conduct of his affairs. This is a regulated and organized use of the thinking function. In this connection, we should recognize a somewhat humiliating truth. These people frequently think and meditate much more efficiently than those who try to do so for psychological or spiritual purposes. If we want to learn to meditate, we must realize that the mind is in reality an instrument, an inner tool from which we must disidentify ourselves if we are to make use of it at will. While we are wholly identified with the mind, we cannot control it. A certain psychological distance, a certain detachment from it, is needed. The practice of concentration is the first step. The next is to direct the activity of the mind along a line we have determined so that it accomplishes the task we have assigned to it. In this sense, to think means to reflect on and deeply explore a subject, examining all its implications, ramifications, and meanings. An attempt on our part to do this will quickly reveal how superficial and inadequate is our normal way of thinking. We are accustomed to reach hurried conclusions and arbitrary generalizations, to consider only one aspect of the subject, and to see or accentuate only what corresponds to our preconceptions or preferences. The first requisite for developing the art of thinking is to watch carefully the process of thinking itself and be instantly aware when a deviation starts. The second involves persistence, tenacity in probing deeply into the subject. Here a curious phenomenon occurs. A few minutes of reflections seem to have exhausted the possibilities of the subject. Nothing further remains to be said about it. But the persistence and reflection at this point will lead to the discovery of other unsuspected aspects, revealing a wealth of development to which we can ascribe no limits. An example will serve to make this clear. Let us take as a theme for meditation the sentence, "I seek love, not hate." At first sight, this appears simple and evident, indeed banal, and makes one think, naturally, being a good person with good intentions, I try to love and not hate. It's so obvious that I can't find anything else to add. But if we ask ourselves, and attempt to answer, the following questions, we shall realize that the matter is not so simple. What does love really mean? What is love? How many and what kinds of love are there? In what ways am I capable of loving? How do I try to love? Whom do I love, and whom do I succeed in loving? Have I always succeeded in loving as I would have wished? If not, why? What have been and are the obstacles, and how can I eliminate them? What portion of my love depends on the people to whom it is directed, and what on my own nature? Then we can examine the word hate and come up with such questions as, behind what camouflage can it hide? Am I free of every type of hate? Do I feel hate toward those who injure me, toward those who are hostile to me? Are such feelings fair? If not, how can they be corrected? What attitude should be adopted towards evil in general? What is the meaning of the saying, an enemy is as useful as a Buddha? And here we have a footnote. A word of warning is in order concerning meditation on negative subjects. A fundamental aspect of meditation consists in intensely focusing our attention on the subject chosen for meditation. This energizes and magnifies it because of the feeding power of attention. See Practical Applications of the Skillful Will, Psychological Breathing and Feeding, page 69. So direct meditation on a negative subject must definitely be avoided. However, meditation on a negative aspect can be safe and useful, provided it is done in a positive way. That is for the purpose of and with our interest resolutely focused on improving the condition or reducing or neutralizing that which is negative. The approach to hate, as described above, is an example of this positive approach, but such meditation is a relatively advanced undertaking. It is best to attempt it after having developed considerable proficiency and control, and only when a definite and specific need arises. Returning to text. It is obvious that we cannot examine all these queries in one meditation. They offer possibilities for reflection for an extended series of meditations. Thus we discover what a wealth of possible elaboration, how much meaning is concealed in such a seemingly simple statement. What are the aims of meditation? We must be clear about them, for they determine the theme to be chosen and the procedure to be adopted. One of the objects of reflective meditation is conceptual, that is, to have a clear idea about a given subject or problem. Clarity of concept is much rarer than is supposed, and the first step here is also to become aware that our ideas are not clear. Another object, more important still, is to acquire knowledge about ourselves. We speak of this later. Some subjects for meditation are 1. The various psychological and spiritual qualities we desire to awaken or strengthen in ourselves. Courage, faith, serenity, joy, will, etc. 2. Symbols. See the extensive discussion of symbols and their uses in psychosynthesis. 3. A sentence expressing a thought. This has been termed a seed thought, of which there are two principal categories. A. Those that seem simple and obvious, like the one we have commented on, I seek to love... B. Those that, on the contrary, are formulated in such a paradoxical way as to be perplexing at first. Their form is built on apparent contradictions, which can be reconciled only by finding a synthesis at a higher and more comprehensive level. The cones of Zen Buddhism are extreme types of these paradoxical seed thoughts. Here are some instances of some paradoxes, which could be called psycho-spiritual quizzes. To act with interest and disinterest. To suffer with joy, which does not mean to enjoy suffering. To make haste slowly. To live in the eternal and the moment. To see action in inaction and inaction in action. The theme of one of the books of Bhagavad Gita. 4. The most important, indeed the indispensable subject for meditation in achieving personal psychosynthesis is reflective meditation on one's self. By means of it, one is able to distinguish between pure self-consciousness or awareness of the self and the psychological elements or parts of one's personality at various levels. This distinction has already been spoken of, but your attention is recalled to it because it is a fundamental prerequisite for acquiring consciousness of the self. This awareness, this possibility of observing one's own personality from above and from a distance interiorly, should not be confused with egocentricity and preoccupation with self. These in reality reflect just the opposite, being identification with the personality elements and concern with personal defects and opinions and judgments of others about ourselves, which often arouse an acute sense of distress. Finally, reflective meditation on ourselves is not to be considered simply a passive process of observation, like making an inventory of facts. It aims at understanding, interpretation and evaluation of what we discover in ourselves. And here we have a footnote. Another word of caution is needed here. Meditation on ourselves can at times cause the emergence in consciousness of disturbing personality elements or the increasing presence of negative emotions. If this occurs, it is because the meditation was done incorrectly. That is, not from a sufficiently objective, disidentified point. but maintaining such a poised point in consciousness is particularly hard when meditating on ourselves, and at first may be too difficult or even impossible for some of us, such as the more introspective or imaginative types. When this is the case, it is advisable to postpone meditating on ourselves and for a time to choose more impersonal topics while also putting much emphasis on the practice of disidentification. And that's the end of footnote, returning to text. 2. Receptive meditation. A clear understanding of the difference between reflective and receptive meditation can be more easily gained by regarding the mind as an inner eye. In reflective meditation, the mind's eye is directed, so to speak, horizontally. It observes the object, the theme of the meditation, the seed thought, or the various aspects of the personality. In receptive meditation, on the other hand, the mind's eye is turned upwards, seeking to discover what is to be discerned at a higher level than that of the ordinary consciousness and of the mind itself. The first stage is silence. The reception from the superconscious of an intuition, an inspiration, a message or stimulus to action requires the elimination of what might impede its descent into the sphere of consciousness. This is why silence is necessary. In this connection, a person accustomed to meditating has reported the following experience. I was immersed in a profound meditation and knew that I had reached a limpid, radiant state when this thought crossed my mind. I know I am at this level, and yet I am deaf and blind and can hear and see nothing. A moment passed, and then this humorous reply came. If you were silent as well, you would be able to see and hear. To keep and maintain inner silence entails a continuous effort. The mind is not accustomed to this discipline. It kicks against the pricks and tries to escape. There are various ways of obtaining mastery over the mind. The first, indicated by Vivekananda, consists in maintaining the steady, patient attitude of the observer for a certain time until the mind tires of its restless activity. This can be practiced patiently for a short period each day. Another method consists in persistently repeating a word or phrase, murmuring the words aloud. A third way is to evoke a mental picture. The most effective words and pictures are those that induce a state of calm, peace, and silence. An appropriate phrase is taken from a hymn of the Greek Mysteries. Be silent, O strings, that a new melody may flow in me. Effective pictures include a tranquil lake which mirrors the blue of the sky, a majestic mountaintop, and especially the starry sky and the silence of the night. In other cases, the opposite difficulty arises. A sense of heaviness or somnolence comes on. This is to be strenuously resisted, since it may lead to a state of passivity in which elements erupt from the unconsciousness, particularly from the lower and collective unconscious, or from extraneous psychic energies. As soon as one is aware of this happening, the condition must be interrupted and the meditation suspended at least for a while. In general, receptive meditation presents greater difficulties than reflective meditation, and its practice must be vigilantly conducted if damaging effects are to be avoided. How and in what form do the messages come? That is, the material we receive. The most common way is by vision or illumination. As has been said, the mind is symbolically an inner eye, and therefore it can see in the sense of understand. It can become aware of the meaning of facts and events, see the solution of a problem, and have a luminous idea. Intuition is a higher form of vision. Etymologically, it is related to vision and means to see within. Intuern. Inturi. At its highest, it can be equated with a direct supra-rational comprehension of the nature of reality, of its essence. It thus differs from what is commonly called intuition, hunches, psychic impressions, presentiments concerning people and events. The inner action of one who is endeavouring to perceive inner reality is called contemplation, or the contemplative state. The highest form of inner vision is illumination, which can be defined as the revelation of the divinity inherent in all things, in nature and living beings. The second effect of receptive meditation may be inner hearing, but here it is also necessary to discriminate carefully between the psychic perception of voices and sounds and true transpersonal hearing. The information coming from the higher levels is for the most part impersonal in character. The messages are brief but pregnant with meaning. They often have a symbolic quality, even when they appear to carry a concrete meaning. A well-known example is the message received by Saint Francis, "Go and restore my church." Initially, he interpreted this as an injunction to rebuild a little ruined church. Later, he understood he had been asked something very different, to restore the church itself, which was in decline in his time. Many artistic, literary, and musical impressions belong in this category of inner hearing. Sometimes a veritable dialogue occurs between the personal I and the self. The mind, recollected in meditation, refers questions and receives inner replies, rapid and clear. When attempting such a dialogue, however, much prudence and discrimination must be exercised. Not infrequently, voices are experienced and messages are received which come from or are transmitted by the personal and collective unconscious, and whose contents do not tally with truth. They can deceive and are apt to dominate and obsess. A third form of receptivity can be termed contact, since it has a certain resemblance to the sense of touch or feeling by contact. It conveys a meaning similar to the content of phrases to establish contact with somebody or to be en rapport with someone. This is an inner contact, one with the self. It indicates a relationship, liaison, or alignment with the self, which renders us receptive to its quality, enabling us to identify or unify ourselves consciously, even if only for a moment, with that spiritual reality. This inner nearness, this touch of the self, harmonizes, vivifies, and recharges us with energy. The fourth way of receiving an impression from the higher self takes the form of a stimulus to action. Our awareness of it arouses in us the urge to do a given thing, embark upon a particular activity, or assume certain duties and tasks. The reception is followed by the stage of registration. That is, a phase in which clear awareness of what has been received is reached, and that awareness is maintained. It is advisable to record immediately in writing what has been perceived. Impressions of high origin are often vivid and clear at the moment, but are apt to vanish rapidly from the field of consciousness, and if not caught and recorded immediately, are often lost. Moreover, the mere fact of fixing them in written terms contributes to a better understanding of them. Even more, the impression sometimes develops while we write, so that, in a certain sense, we continue to receive. Another interesting kind of receptivity is delayed reception. It frequently happens that during receptive meditation, nothing seems to occur, and we remain in a state of darkness. Nothing new appears on the surface of consciousness, except a general sense of calm and repose. But this does not necessarily mean that the meditation has been fruitless. Often, during the day or following days, an impression or inspiration presents itself unexpectedly. It can come at any moment while one is engaged in some completely different activity, or in moments of repose, or on awaking in the morning. Sometimes one can trace the relationship between the apparently unsuccessful meditation and the subsequent inspiration. Therefore, after the close of a meditation, we should maintain an inner attitude of watchful waiting, definable as the meditative attitude, which, when developed by exercise, can be persisted in more or less throughout the day. We can thus train ourselves to hold a state of double awareness. This implies the ability to concentrate normally on our outer activities and keep a part of the attention directed towards the inner world. I would offer also these technical suggestions on meditation. Cease meditating for a time whenever overstimulation or its symptoms occur, nervous tension, emotional excitement, feverish activity. The length of time to be spent on meditation varies. To begin with, it should not exceed 10 or 15 minutes. That is quite long enough. The period during which one subject should be used as the theme also varies, but it should not be less than a week. And after some practice, one often finds a month too short. Some subjects appear to be virtually inexhaustible. A good method is to meditate on a series of themes in rotation. One theme to be used each week until the series is gone through again. Finally, there is one way of practicing receptive meditation that offers many advantages. Group meditation helps concentration, with few exceptions, confers a mutual integration and protection, and moreover, makes possible a reciprocal verification and sharing of each member's results. 3. Creative meditation. Meditation can be creative because it is inner action. A contrast is sometimes made between meditation and action, but this is erroneous. The mastery and application of psychological and spiritual energies are actions, for they require will, training, and the employment of appropriate techniques. And above all, because they are effective, they produce results. There are various purposes for which we can use creative meditation. The first and most important is self-creation. By means of meditation, we can modify, transform, and regenerate our personality. One effective way of doing this is the ideal model exercise, see psychosynthesis. It may be regarded as a model of creative meditation. We are using the creative power of thought and all other psychological forces continuously, spontaneously, and I would say inevitably, but usually we do so without being aware of it, haphazardly, and thus with little constructive effect, or at worst, with definite injury to ourselves and others. A beneficial application demands above all that we ascertain the motives that animate us, and that we accord passage only to the good ones, those which are the expression of the will to good. It is then necessary to determine our objectives precisely. In the present period of reconstruction, new forms are being built in every sphere of life, and we can cooperate by assisting in the creation and manifestation of ideas that inform, animate, and mould these new forms. The various stages of creative meditation are 1. Clear conception and precise formulation of the idea. 2. Use of the imagination, i.e. clothing of the idea in pictures and suggestive symbols. 3. Vivifying the idea with warmth of feeling and the propulsive force of desire. An extensive outline of a meditation on the will is given below. The same pattern with suitable modifications can be used for other subjects. It can also be adopted according to the specific aim as well as the psychological type of the meditator. Outline of meditation on the will. 1. Preparation. And then we have a sublist. 1. Physical relaxation, emotional composure, mental recollection. 2. Concentration. Realization of the point of pure self-awareness. 3. Elevation, directing the aspiration of the heart and the attention of the mind towards the self. 4. Identification. Imaginative and affirmative identification with the self. 2. Reflective meditation. Here we have suggested themes, also a sublist. 1. One of the stages of the volitional act. Purpose, aim, goal, valuation, motivation, intention. Deliberation. Choice, decision. Affirmation, command. Planning and programming. Direction of the execution. 2. One of the qualities of the will. Energy, dynamic power, intensity, mastery, control, discipline, concentration, attention, one-pointedness, focus, determination, decisiveness, resoluteness, promptness, persistence, endurance, patience, initiative, courage, daring, organization, integration, synthesis. 3. Use of symbols. Sublist 1. Visualization. Visualize vividly and steadily a symbol of the will. Suggested images. A. A flaming torch. B. Fire. C. A lance. D. A scepter. A scepter. E. Crown. F. A tower. G. A mountaintop illuminated by the rising sun. H. A charioteer holding the reins of 3 horses. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. I. A man at the helm of a boat. J. An orchestra conductor conducting. 2. Auditory symbols. Suggested sound. Siegfried's motive. By Wagner. 4. Receptive meditation. Sublist 1. Appeal. Let the will of the self guide and direct my life. 2. Reception. Silent realization of the downflow of will energy into the personality at all levels. Mental, emotional, physical. 5. Affirmation. I proclaim and celebrate the will in thought and word and deed. 6. Expression. Sublist. 1. Say aloud. The will to good of the self expresses itself in me as goodwill. 2. Choose and formulate some definitive use of the will to be demonstrated in daily life. End of Appendix 2.